This is Mae Russell. This is tape number 851, March the 28th, 1988. In keeping with some of the recent obituaries I've been sharing with you, there was one just yesterday in the paper, Indian activist slain in North Carolina, Wakulla, North Carolina. A Lumbee Indian activist running for judge in his racially troubled county was found shot to death Saturday. Julian T. Pierce, who complained to friends of death threats, was shot three times at point blank. He was actually assassinated. Remember last week I shared the one about the racing car chief, one of the fastest racers in the world. He and his wife were gunned down. The term assassinated was used. This article said Pierce was an attorney in nearby Pembroke County. He resigned as director of the Lumbee River Legal Services, which provided legal representation to low-income county residents to seek a newly created superior court judgeship. A longtime friend said he spent several hours with Pierce on Friday and said Pierce was threatened and feared for his life. "We are looking for this to happen. We were looking," said a friend of his. "He knew something could happen. I won't go into it now. If he had been white, he wouldn't be dead today." And, of course, Robert Morgan, director of the State Bureau of Investigation, said in quotes, "We don't have any motive. The motive is he was an Indian running as a judge. He was a political person, and he was an attorney who had gotten off the Indian reservation, so to speak, and was working himself into the county and the community into a position of status. The motive is perfectly obvious." A close friend of mine, who I referred to as the co-speaker with me, Speaker of the House, on Reaganese. We've spoken Reaganese for years, and she has some really great ideas, and she came up with something this morning, and that was the fact that with Jesse Jackson winning so many votes, possibility in Michigan becoming so popular, and the momentum building around the United States, that there's a possibility that Jesse Jackson could run against George Bush. And she suggested that if Jackson were to be assassinated, either as soon as he's elected or before he is elected, before the election, just as Robert Kennedy was killed the night of his primary, if Jackson were to be assassinated, the intelligence community and the military could have set up already planning a lot of agent provocateurs, and the black people with a natural instinct of anger finally getting somebody who speaks for them, who represents them, who got them to register to vote, if they are angry and hurt that if Jesse Jackson were to be murdered, then they may be rioting in the streets, set off again by provocateurs, in which case the Ollie North Gefreda National Security Federal Emergency Management would come into being at that point, something that has been handed around since before Reagan was president, when Reagan was governor, and Ed Meese was his legal advisor. So a good suggestion, possibly before the elections, is to spread the word that all black people and others that might be so inclined to riot, such as those in the Bay Area concerning the airplanes in Honduras and so forth, have planned meetings just as you would in any other emergency, such as earthquakes and floods or whatever, and have a contingency set of meetings across the country. What will we do if Jesse Jackson is murdered? And go inside the House and have a silent protest and demand in advance that anyone who throws rocks, breaks windows, destroys buildings, sets fire, be identified and recognized by the black community as being an infiltrator or so forth, and that everybody, in the event that Jesse Jackson is murdered, go into their home for 1 week or 2 weeks, get supplies, and stay in their home as if there was this emergency, and don't give the country an excuse to round up those 21 million blacks and vaporize them the way is suggested from the National Security Council in the King Alfred plan. This would be a perfect way to anger the blacks as excuse to do what was planned for a long time. So think about that one and maybe suggest it and pass it on to people, if you will. Now, along the line of death threats, and I just cite this particular Indian activist who was getting death threats and knew he was going to get an attack, he was told, and regarding the message I got, this past Wednesday I got a letter, and I'll share it with you, and after I read it I told several of my friends that it sounded like the Writing School of E. Howard Hunt, sort of the psych war letters that were sent to Reverend Martin Luther King and other people. And then just by coincidence, I learned that Friday, 2 days later, that G. Gordon Liddy, E. Howard Hunt's friend and co-worker in crime, was on the Monterey Peninsula staying at a new hotel that's part of the Pebble Beach Group. It's owned by Marvin Davis. When Marvin Davis bought 20th Century Fox, he put Henry Kissinger and Gerald Ford on the board immediately, and William Rogers is on the board also. So the hotel chain is owned by Marvin Davis, but just coincidentally, G. Gordon Liddy, the great agent provocateur, a member of the Soldier of Fortune entourage with Mr. Brown and John Singlaub, enjoyed our nice Monterey Peninsula this weekend. I'm only going to read parts of this letter. I've blacked it out like the FBI does on their reports because it involves my family, members of my family, and I'll only cite the references to one of them because the others are so horrible. I really don't even want to share it with you long listeners and friends, but I'll read the parts that I think are pertinent that you get the tone of the letter. It said, "Dear May," of course, unsigned and undated. It was postmarked in San Jose. "Dear May, 'twas with a bit of glee I heard the glorious news. May calls it quits. Well, now, ain't she something?" I said to myself. I mean, how could someone who became the embarrassment of any well-educated and informed radical have the arrogance and sense of self-importance to take these death threats seriously? May, why on earth would anyone want to kill you? You were nothing more than cheap entertainment for those with so little ingenuity that they needed such childish simplifications, such neat, well-connected conspiracies. It may have been cheap entertainment for him, I might say, but it hasn't been cheap for me. The expenses of the research come to almost $10,000 or $20,000 a year, book subscriptions, tapes, etc. He continues, "It was always my contention that you were, back in the days when I knew you personally," he throws that in, "nothing more than an agent yourself, planted to keep the people's minds off more serious things." Of course, I interject here, more serious than political assassinations, more serious things. "You were nothing more than an unusual type of bread and circus," and he puts it in the past tense, "you were. Your ramblings were as successful as Nixon or Reagan ever dreamed of being in keeping the people off balance, paranoid, and misinformed. As I remember you, you seemed angry, arrogant, rude, and irresponsible," as he remembered me personally. Then he refers to my son, who was given LSD in the fall of 1967, just at the time that I was in New Orleans, meeting Jim Garrison. He said, "You simply blamed this, what happened to him, the mental problems after he was administered acid, not surprisingly, upon the CIA. Good Lord, did the local Republicans have a good laugh on that one?" Local Republicans. It is, and then there's another paragraph here I've blocked out that refers some more to the family. "It was time to atone for the tragedies, criticizing, unhappy, and bitching self that you are. Goodbye, May, and I thank God I no longer have to hear that tiny, whiny voice and such dizzy mumblings ever again." Now, I wasn't aware that anybody had to hear World Watchers. That is optional on a radio band. He'd only have to hear it once and turn it, unless he was assigned to hear it and had to hear it. "I no longer have to hear it. The stations that I've been on aren't so great that he would have to catch it on every band, like we get Robert Novak on television, weekdays and weekends." Now, the man who gave my son LSD, his name is Peter Gilman. He's an author who now lives in Mexico. He wrote the book and movie Diamond Head. He used to say when he was in my home, "What would you do if I was in the CIA?" He had a home, a lot of property in Carmel, and in one home where somebody rented it afterwards, who still lives there, rents it from Peter Gilman, said that he was telephonically in touch with no less than Aristotle Onassis during this whole period. There were two people in my home, Gene Durkas and Vic Spiegel. Gene lives in San Francisco, Vic in Los Angeles. They were there when Carolyn and Pete administered the LSD and then took my son down to Big Sur. And Eric Byrne, who knew my son, said that he had been poisoned. He advised the doctors who saw him that his personality change could only come from poison. So that's a little bit of what I got this week in the mail, and he no longer has to hear me. So, as I say, I wonder if he was assigned to hear me. He was with a little bit of glee that that job was over, and now he can do something else. By far the largest bit of news in the paper this week, I believe, is the agreement of the Contras and Sandinistas for a 60-day truce. It's time that we stop those wars in Central America. It's very, very important that we stop them. I've always contended that these actions that are forced to make changes regarding political affairs are not because of decent motives, not because the powers that be have determined this is enough war and killing, let's pull back. These changes, I think, are made on blackmail, on information having power, and the opposing side, usually the weaker one, has information against the bullies. Now, Ronald Reagan was determined when he came in office from January 81 up through 88 that the government of Nicaragua would be overthrown. He also was determined that Gaddafi would be out of Libya and that Khomeini would be out of Iran. But what went wrong? In the Central American story, as soon as Eugene Hasenfuss landed October the 5th, 1986, that began to change the story of the Contras because it forced an examination into the Contras. And then when the Lebanese paper Al-Shara printed about the U.S. arms to Iran, November the 3rd, 1986, the story began to fall apart. And a lot of credit has to be given to Daniel Sheehan and members of the Christic Institute, putting their lives on the line, because when they filed their suit in 1986, in May of 86, charging the Contras, the freedom fighters, with drug traffic, gun running, and political assassinations, they called attention to a particular group of people that were identifiable and identical when Hasenfuss landed. Now, the House-Senate hearings began on the Iran-Contra affair, and while they didn't get into the drug problems, Senator Kerry's hearings did get into the drugs and the drug traffic, and we began to hear witnesses like Mr. Blundon and Mr. Rodriguez telling about the CIA, the narcotics traffic, the links to the Medellin cartel, the specific cartel that is named in the Christic Institute suit. And also they learned that the profits for the enterprise stayed in the enterprise, didn't go to the men dying in the fields. That came out of the hearings. A good bunch of the money didn't get to the Contras at all. And even the money allocated by Congress for the Contras was diverted and never explained. So I believe it's a combination of factors. When Congress then turned down money for the Contras, that they realized that across the board it was time to call it quits, and I believe the scandals played a major role in that. There was a story in the San Francisco Chronicle, March 25th, Inside the Colombian Drug Cartel, and this tells about raiding the home location of drug czar Pablo Escobar. He's a defendant in the Christic Institute, and the Colombian police rounded up a large group of people on the compound of Escobar, and they told about bribes and contract killings and their bodyguard salaries, and the information just from the premises of Pablo Escobar could link to this administration, and the Contras are through because they dealt directly with Escobar and Jorge Osha and the whole group that the Christic Institute had brought into prominence by naming them. The Miami Herald had a long article February 27th, Drugs for the Contra Arms Backfires, and it tells about money being put, of course, on the streets of the United States to support the Contras, drug money here in the United States. And most of you have seen many of these articles on the drug traffic, but how the United States supported the Contras and their drug operations and knew they were going on. And, of course, the Justice Department in Florida was kept from pursuing these investigations because of people like Ollie North and Elliot Abrams and Edwin Meese putting a lid on the investigations for a while. Even the Southwest Times Record from Fort Smith, Arkansas, that I started taking because of the trial for treason for the Aryan Nations, has a large editorial section, Were There Illegal U.S.-Noriega Ties? And the article says, central to the dilemma of testimony being heard now is that Noriega's key aide, Jose Blandon, senior member of the Panama Intelligence Organization, was accepting $4.6 million for a safe haven. Blandon's testimony that Noriega accepted this to provide a safe haven for narcotics and money trafficking. And Blandon went on to talk about the Colombia cartel, the Medellin narcotics, and the links to the Contras. So the papers were filled with stories about these links that will not wash away. But it is time for the Contras to make peace with the Sandinistas, because all of the adjective used to describe Daniel Ortega and the Sandinistas can't be equal to the holy terror of the Medellin cartel and what it's done to this country and to the banking establishment and people on the streets and the death squads and so forth. So two equal forces meet now, not the Contras, backed by the mighty United States, but the Contras and the Contras and Sandinistas having to get together. People's Daily World had a marvelous long article by Tim Wheeler on this testimony before the Senate committee about Contras, drug smuggling, assassinations, and it tells how Elliot Abrams went down to Miami to meet with Panama President Eric Duvalier, the guy who is sort of hiding, hoping he'll be president of Panama. He never will. Incidentally, the attorney for Eric Arturo Duvalier happens to be none other than William Rogers, a member of the board of 20th Century with Marvin Davis, a co-partner of Kissinger Associates of Henry Kissinger. William Rogers is the attorney for Duvalier, and this whole group are trying to separate themselves, I'm sure, from the drugs and the assassination teams, and the Contras are left isolated, and we can no longer support the Contras. This is a long article from People's Daily World, two pages, very well written. Tim Wheeler has done very many good articles on the Iran-Contra affair, and he tells about the money washing through the Boston Bank, the first Boston Bank, money laundering in, $40 billion annually going through various banks and the Bank of America, and incidences of cocaine traffic on Mr. John Hall's ranch. And John Hall is both CIA and national security, linked to both of those, and drug money going into the Federal Reserve Bank. Half of $1.1 billion last year went to the Federal Reserve. So with all of this coming down, I don't see how we can support the freedom fighters, as the president called them, and therefore it is time to call it quits. And while the White House doesn't like the fact that these people are not going to fight each other, these people down there, the Contras and the Sandinistas, know that it is time that they got their act together and not let the United States play around with them. Just as we're playing around with our old friend Noriega in Panama, the Sandinistas can get the same treatment in another hour for drug running and trafficking. And I think now they've come to their senses and they're going to sit down and try to make peace. Ronald Reagan is truly an amazing character. He's so transparent. If, like I do with my friend, you talk Reagan, as you can see, everything that his little mind is working is like a plastic telephone, and you can see the wires. Just about a week ago, Oliver North said he had to resign from the Marines, that he may subpoena high officials. His attorney told him that the defense against these charges may require him to call the highest-ranking officials of our government. This was in the L.A. Times. Every paper had this story. This was March the 19th. And the report went on, the remark is aimed directly at the White House, at President Reagan, Vice President Bush, and Bush's top staff, because everybody else who knew North at that time is out of office. And then, 1 week later, March 26th, Reagan, allegedly off the cuff, but he can't send a message or telephone to North anymore, he answers what you say is one more question that he doesn't have to really do. And in response to the fact that North says, I may subpoena the highest up, meaning Reagan and Bush, Reagan comes out and says, I still think Ollie North is a hero. I just have to believe that they're all going to be found innocent, because if they were guilty of any law breaking or any crime, I don't think they were. I haven't seen any notice of anything illegal. So, you know, 1 week, Ollie North says, I may have to call you, boss, to testify for me. And then the boss responds, not by saying, of course, I'll answer every question. He says, you're innocent. You're innocent, because if you're innocent, I'm innocent. So Reagan right away says, I'm talking to a hero. This guy's a hero. He won't be indicted for anything. He'll be let off the hook. So that's a knee-jerk response to what North said. that he's really saying both of us are innocent. The San Francisco Chronicle has a long article about a San Francisco lawyer by the name of John Keeker, K-E-K-E-R, from the law office of Keeker and Brockett. And he's in Washington now working with a special prosecutor. And his background is that he was in the Marines. He went to Princeton's Woodrow Wilson School of Foreign Policy. And before that, he went to Yale Law School. Now, Judge Gissell, who's going to hear the case, is also a graduate of Yale Law School. But the important question about the case is answered over and over again by intelligent people, and John Keeker summarized it in the Chronicle interview. He said, the idea of foreign policy going outside the channels of accountability is disturbing. The idea of American foreign policy or any kind of government going off the books outside accountability and oversight, I think, ought to disturb anybody. What he doesn't say is the accountability of the military spying on people in the United States and turning in the records on the United States. There were a lot of problems here. Well, I'm sure he's aware of all of them. But the accountability leaving our government and getting into a private business called the enterprise that runs our country is very, very serious. And then the LA Times has a long article about Judge Gerhard Gissell, the judge that's going to hear this case. He was the judge on the Watergate case. And March 18th, the LA Times has a story. 14 years ago, President Nixon's former appointment secretary, Dwight Chapin, stood before Judge Gerhard Gissell, and he was charged with perjury stemming from Watergate. None of the people in the Watergate were charged for the crimes that they did. They twisted around and didn't make them accountable for crimes. They made them accountable for lying about not telling what they did, and were never sentenced for what they did. And this is what is going to happen again with the Iran-Contra. It's going to repeat itself, just as Watergate covered up. This will cover up. But in the course of the article, referring to Judge Gissell, Jim Mann writes, he quotes Gissell sentencing Dwight Chapin, "You apparently chose loyalty to your superiors above your obligations as a citizen and public servant," the judge told him. And with that, he imposed on the ex-White House aide and first offender the relatively stiff sentence of at least 10 months in prison. Isn't that a joke? Dwight Chapin, 10 months in prison. And during that time, he was paid a salary every month that he would have earned as the chief of the White House by Clement Stone, the intense religious fundamentalist, the man out of Chicago and Texas who writes books on how to be a success. He paid the salary of Dwight Chapin. And as soon as the United Airlines went down with Dorothy Hunt on it outside of Chicago, Dwight Chapin left the White House and moved to Chicago to be in charge of the investigation of the United Airlines, and then was paid a salary. So the stiff sentence is 10 months in prison. So just go forward a little bit and see what's going to happen to these people, these characters, if they even get sentenced. Now, one of the favorite stories that I've had for the past 2 years has been kept up in the news somewhat, and somewhat just hidden, but made every account this week. That's the sentencing of Mordecai Vanunu. Even 60 Minutes had a segment, and of course 60 Minutes didn't even scratch the surface of what Vanunu's story is about, but they tried to tell those people that don't even get a newspaper to know about Vanunu. I've covered the story of Mordecai Vanunu since August of 1986. On August the 25th, 1986, there was an explosion in Cameroon. On August 26, one day later, Shimon Peres, the controversial Shimon Peres, the same gentleman, Prime Minister of Israel, who was meeting with Edwin Meese and his team to set up over $1 million payment for, allegedly, for the not bombing the Iraqi pipeline that the National Security Council was going to build, that involved this discourse, involved Mr. William Webster and Edwin Meese. Shimon Peres went to Cameroon the day after the explosion, and September 30th, 1986, 1 month later, Vanunu had been taken away from London by a woman linked to the Central Intelligence Agency and the Mossad, And then October the 5th, five days later, the London Sunday Times ran the story about Vanunu and the Israeli capability with atomic bombs, but the London Times also mentioned neutron bombs. And I believed as early as August 25th, 1986, 3 weeks before the London Times article came out, that Shimon Peres was in Cameroon because of the neutron bomb, and had sent Israeli scientists to Cameroon to check the reaction that Israel was testing the neutron bomb for the United States. Now, the story of the Israeli spy gets 18 years for selling nuclear secrets, but what they said on 60 Minutes was that nothing could come out on their tape or sound or sight of the Vanunu case that wasn't seen first by the Israeli government. And the sentencing of Vanunu includes that he will continue to be held in total isolation for 18 years, maybe 12 years if he doesn't talk. And doesn't talk must include not going into more specifics of the capabilities that he gave the London Times. They were printed there. Now, I did broadcasts on this matter continuously from the time of the Cameroon explosion, dating the article, it was the San Francisco Examiner, August 25th, that described 17-member Israeli Army medical team going to Cameroon, and then saying, one person there saying that the area looks like it had been hit by a neutron bomb. I didn't come up with it first. It was a Catholic priest interviewed in the Examiner who mentioned neutron bomb, and then I began to read the different discrepancies in the account of what happened in Cameroon. And I've updated this for you, the Politics of Cameroon broadcast September the 1st, number 769, September the 8th, 770, April the 6th, broadcast 800, and cited articles that were in the People's Daily World and in the Washington Post and in the London Times on Israel and the neutron bomb. And then a friend from Germany sent me articles that I shared with you on the neutron bomb in Europe, with Germany and France ready to deploy it, working together. And if you want those back broadcasts, they are available on the neutron bomb and Israel. After the original London Times story broke about the capability of the neutron bomb, and Vanunu had been kidnapped 5 days before that was published, another story came out in the London Times saying Vanunu, Israel's PM, faces writ. Legal moves are due to start this weekend to establish the whereabouts of Vanunu. He was missing. The nuclear technician who disappeared in London September 30th, after revealing to the Sunday Times the secrets of his country's nuclear arsenal. And these secrets, it continued, despite a series of interviews questioning his behavior and contacts, he was able not only to gather comprehensive details about plutonium extraction, the manufacture of advanced thermonuclear materials like lithium-6 and tritium, used almost exclusively for hydrogen and neutron bombs. And he penetrated the security there enough to smuggle out 60 photographs of these particular installations. The Christian Science Monitor, October 15th, 1987, John Judge found the article where, of course, there were denials, but stories that the Nigerian newspaper charged the U.S. and Israel set off a neutron bomb in Lake Nyos area of Cameroon last year, in which thousands of Cameroonians were killed. And, of course, Nigeria is close to that scene. And I have tried to update these stories for you. December the 11th, 1987, the Washington Post, public kept in dark, Israel's secret treason trial. This goes into the secrecy of Vanunu. He can't see reporters. He is virtually isolated from everybody. The Israeli press laws can order the suppression of information deemed damaging to the state security. And Vanunu revealed that Israel's arsenal included more than 100 hydrogen, neutron, and atomic devices, Washington Post. So the Cameroon story is not solved. Vanunu has to keep quiet or he'll never get out. He could be killed in jail. But he has been sentenced to 18 years of isolation. And the big story that's kept quiet is that Israel did test the neutron bomb for the United States in Cameroon. We'll take a one-second break so you can turn over this tape. The tape will take a break itself. It runs out. So I'll be back with you as soon as we turn over the first side of this tape.